This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Today is the week after the first day of summer. Longest day of the year was last year. Dr. Lyle, how is Sacramento treating you?
Good. It was in the hundreds last week, but now we've calmed down into the 90-ish, and it's just great. It's terrific.
Excellent. I was reading an article about Sacramento drivers. It turns out they're rated as the worst drivers in the whole country. And it reminded me of what you were saying a couple podcasts earlier, when you just had this rage when people follow you too closely behind you. And I just imagine how stressful that might be.
I'm just fully justified, just as we continue to see how accurate my nervous system is.
Well,
all right.
Speaking of which, today's show is titled, it's called Confidence and Tolerance and Finding Your Own Purpose, just based on the questions that we've received this week and some of the questions we didn't get to last week. But before we start with the questions and emails from our listeners, I was reading an article, and this is from the Illinois News Bureau, and I couldn't actually get the journal article because it was behind a pay site, and of course I'm cheap. Mm-hmm. So I love how you just agree with me right away. So I was trying to read this article, couldn't find it, but I found the news article, and it's basically reviewing a journal research project where they studied whether sex actually sells. Now, I grew up thinking sex sells. Every marketing article I read, everything that had to do with sales, always said sex sells and sex appeal is what gets viewers to buy the products. But there was an analysis of about 80 advertising studies published over more than 30 years that suggests that sex actually doesn't sell. And what they found was that people remember ads with sex appeals more than those that without it, but they don't actually buy the brand or the product featured in the ads. And so really, really interesting. And this was the Journal of International Journal of Advertising. But they found that not only were study participants no more likely to remember the brands, they were more likely to have a negative attitude towards those brands. And they showed they showed no greater interest in making a purchase. And here's the quote from the study lead author. He said, "We found literally zero effect on participants' intention to buy products and ads with a sex appeal. And the assumption that sex sells, well, no, according to our study, it doesn't. And there's no indication there's a positive effect."
You know, that's very interesting. And I have to say, I'm not even that surprised. I can remember, as people have heard me say, one of the great minds in psychology today is Jeffrey Miller. And his book Spent discusses essentially consumer behavior. And one of the things he got clear for me, and which was very interesting, which is that you will hear around people thinking deeply about advertisement, people will talk about how people, quote, identify with a product. And then there's some concerted efforts to have like phallic symbols in products and so forth. And I always considered that sort of thing and all of it, even the concept of, quote, identifying with the product, as being insane. It never made any sense to me at all. It didn't make any sense to me when I was 22 hearing about it, and it didn't make any sense to me 30 years later. And Miller, because I wasn't even paying attention, because I'm not a consumer psychologist or, you know, advertising psychologist or anything like this. So none of that. I wasn't paying any attention to any of this. And Miller came along and said that the concept in advertising was that sort of a person has almost like a relationship with the product. And he said, amazingly naive about what's actually going on in human behavior. Human behavior are people are interested in products to signal to other people. That is what they're doing. And so the fact that somebody sexy is holding, you know, some Pond's cold cream, it's like, well, that's not signaling to a third party. We're not seeing how this thing would work to, et cetera. There's a vague notion of imitation, but the Pond's cold cream isn't going to give you, a great bone structure. This is not going to happen. And so it always seemed to me remarkably naive. Now, I could see the impact of imitation in behavior. And imitation is a powerful phenomenon throughout the animal kingdom. So I could see that there could be, you know, an imitative process going on. But some of the sort of blatant, essentially the blatant linking of a given product to theoretically that attractive people are interested in the product never rang true to me, and now it turns out it doesn't ring true to anybody. So this is really interesting that somebody went to the trouble to actually put this under the empirical magnifying glass, and I'm glad they did. And it actually rings correct to me that they've now set this right. Good job. Glad you found it.
Yeah, and I was wondering why, like, it made sense to me that people wouldn't necessarily associate, by the product or brand. What was interesting to me is that people actually had a negative attitude towards those brands. And I wonder if it has to do with something we talked about when we did our show called The Psychology of Humor. And it's that people enjoy watching the person who's up there getting a lot of status when they lose status. And so here we have a really pretty or good looking person in the advertisement. They've got very few gene mutations, so they're obviously above us. And here they are getting more status, you know. So of course everyone's going to be a little nervous and upset and a little jealous, you know.
Yeah, and there's it even goes one layer deeper. Like I don't even remember who it might have been. It might have been certainly Joe Montana when he married the girl that was the Schick sheriff, and. But there's been many other times when some very good-looking guy, maybe he has some cologne on or some stupid thing, or his hair or is shaving, you know, and now we're supposed to, and then a really great-looking girl is coming on to him. And it's like, oh, really? The product has anything to do with this? Like, we know the product doesn't have anything to do with this. And now not only is this whole thing not fun, really, but in addition, it's also the case that I can feel like you're manipulating me, and you're sending a promise out to me about how you're going to improve my mating status, and you're lying to me. And so there's even it even goes deeper than just being irritated at watching somebody else win in a situation that we can't. So there's a lot of little pieces to this are interesting. Now, of course, I think we're going to find that, you know, attractive people are probably better salespeople than less attractive people. So, but the message has to be subtle, and it can't be trying to hit us over the head with something that is not only not true but not pleasant to see. So, very good. Good thinking.
Yeah,
now we're going to get better analysis of this.
Yeah, this should be interesting. I just to your point, I heard a speaker talking about something a long time ago, and he basically said exactly what you said. And his point was, a tactic known is a tactic blown, and so you've got to be subtle in the way you're saying things. Otherwise, people just see right through it. One of the things for some of the skeptics listening, who might think of an ad that they really enjoyed. That actually had sex appeal in it. The way they actually measure if an ad is effective or not is whether it moves product. And also the way the researchers figure out if an ad was an effective or not was they see how quickly it took the advertising agency to change the actual commercial. Because they say when the product is moving, people don't make changes. So if they're noticing a company, you know, changing ads all the time, even though it has sex appeal, that's a good reason why it's not working.
Yeah, just remember, where's the beef? You know, for those of you that are too young, you're probably too young. Do you remember where's the beef?
I remember beef. Nate? It's what's for dinner.
Oh, no, no, you're too young. All right, so way back, this is probably in the 1970s. Yeah, it was Walter Mondale was running for president, so this would have been 1984. And right about that time, because he made the famous comment that sunk Gary Hart. Gary Hart was a presidential front runner. This was Democratic Party. And in their debate, Mondale said, where's the beef? And it cracked up everybody, and it put Gary Hart, he was like a deer in the headlights about his proposals. Where's the beef was there was a tiny little lady. She was probably about 4 foot 10 inches tall. And it was these three little old ladies, and they were going out to have their burgers, and they're at some fancy place. And this little tiny, you know, lady Esther or whatever her name was would pick up her thing and say, where's the beef? Because there's some tiny little burger and some tiny little patty in it. And she had this squawky little old lady's grouchy voice. And then later she did the same thing with the famous NFL Hall of Famer Dick Butkus, who was towering over her. And she says, where's the beef? And so she was just – it was so successful. This was for Wendy's. Essentially taking a swipe at McDonald's, basically saying that McDonald's beef patties are really – small and steamrolled out and tiny little patties, and Wendy's, we've got real beef. Well, here's the problem. It was so successful that they were running out of beef all over Wendy's. They couldn't even – they didn't have enough burgers. It was actually turned into a short-term serious disaster because they literally didn't have enough food. So that is a successful ad with exactly zero sex appeal. So there we go.
Yeah. Very interesting article. All right. So let's move on to some of the listener emails. Again, we've gotten fantastic questions. These are just amazing. And I really appreciate everybody emailing me and interacting with our show. Really love the listenership here. Okay. So first question, dear Dr. Lyle, I've been thinking about some people close to me, and I'm always so surprised when they display such levels of confidence that I sometimes feel is unwarranted. For example, someone who pursues a singing career, but truthfully, they can't sing better than a shower performance. Or someone who claims to be very empathetic, but then complains about every person they run into. How is it that people can have such a thwarted sense of self?
This is a thing of beauty. Okay. All right. Great question. Just wonderful. Very astute. Now, what we're going to let me back the camera out and give you an understanding of what you're looking at. The self, which is sort of one of three parts of how it is that I look at the human mind. So, for those that haven't heard us before, we have the self, we have the esteem meter, and then we have the internal audience. So we've effectively got, you know, this is my equivalent of the id, the ego, and the superego. Okay, that we can trash that, those ideas that are 100 years old. Now we've got something different. We've got another tripartite look at the mind. We've got the self, we've got the esteem meter, and we've got the internal audience. Now, the self is actually, that's what you sort of recognize as you. The esteem meter is a device for you to pick up cues from the outside world about what they think of your displays. And you're displaying or advertising in order to achieve relationships in work, love, and friendships. So we're doing advertising displays in our hair, our clothing, our resumes, our houses, our cars, our church that we go to, and everything, and the music we listen to, and the paintings that we paint, everything under the sun. So human beings are making displays in order to secure transactions of various kinds. And in that process, that's a competitive process, we have an esteem meter that's picking up cues from outside people about whether they think well of us or think poorly of us. And our feelings are largely a derivative of the feedback that we get from other people. And then finally, we have an internal audience that is watching us from within as if they were outside people. And they are also giving us feedback, but they're giving us feedback on our private demonstrations or our private efforts as we try to make ourselves beautiful or handsome, or we try to work on a cool song on the guitar. We are watching ourselves and listening to ourselves, and then the internal audience gives us positive or negative feedback depending upon the displays that we make in front of no one except ourselves. So these are the three components, but the self here is what's involved. So the self, you might say, well, what is that? Well, what it is largely is a set of comparative analyses about our capabilities relative to other people. And the reason why it's important to have the set of analyses is that you're essentially going to assess what kinds of competitions you should be getting into and what kinds you shouldn't. So if someone comes, some 40-year-old lady comes to me and says, well, she's looks like she's going to lose her job and she's not sure what she's going to do about it, what I don't say is I don't say, well, the LA Rams have a job at quarterback that's open and they pay $20 million a year. She would immediately herself knows that that's absurd. That is not a competition that she's interested in. Now, maybe she's a CPA and she just got laid off from a big five firm or whatever. And I say, well, no problem. There's a job at Starbucks right down the street. What's the problem? No, she's fancier than that. So you're designed by nature to essentially assess what you are capable of competing for. And you're designed to set your goals in accordance with what it is that you have comparative evidence that you think that you could achieve. So this is what Albert Bandura terms self-efficacy. So what you self-efficacy is built upon, or self-confidence, which is the feeling that derives from a self-efficacy computation. What Bandura swore up and down his whole life that self-efficacy is not the same thing as self-confidence. Now, he really wasn't splitting hairs, but the truth of the matter is that the two are intimately related. The self-efficacy judgment is a computation about what you think you're capable of doing. The self-confidence is, we can remove the term self if we want. It's the confident, it's what you feel. So those two are completely related to each other. One is the feeling, one is the thought that drives the feeling. So the thought that drives the feeling is the self-efficacy judgment, which is computed by comparing yourself to relevant others in the domain. So two guys that are both working to get that starting quarterback job on the LA Rams, they're watching each other and competing with each other and trying to decide whether or not they think they can be the starter. So you use relevant others as you compete for ecological niches. That's what happens. So an aging actress who's 65 is not looking for the lead role of the beauty in some movie that's going to star some 35-year-old heartthrob. That doesn't make sense. So people compete within these ecological niches, and the self's job is to run these computations and to try to figure out what do we think I'm capable of doing. Now this is where it gets interesting. With respect to this question. And the issue is that we have evidence that the human, so the self is generating goals is what it's doing. It essentially says, I think that this is the competitive reach of what it is that we can do. Now, we have evidence that suggests that in general, human beings' estimates of what they're capable of doing are overreaches. So they tend to think more of themselves than is true. Now, this makes sense if you think about how this would have evolved in an evolutionary fashion. Let's suppose that you are a girl and you are a seven, okay? So in essence, your mating market is going to be somewhere around a seven. Now, it would be probably clever of evolution to have you think that you're an eight. And the reason that would be true is you don't want to be too quick to make a deal that is not quite as good a deal as you can get. You should, in fact, set the system up to be a little bit narcissistic, okay, a little bit full of yourself, so that you can find out from experience whether or not you've overrated it. If you can imagine the disaster that would take place if someone underrated themselves, then they would be essentially trading for mates, friends, and in trade in a way that would be disadvantageous. Now, you might say, why doesn't the system get it accurately? And the reason is that because of the subjective nature of value on the other side of the equation, in the heads of other people trading with us, we aren't exactly sure what we're worth, okay? So they don't hand you a number and they say, you're a 70th percentile looking 22-year-old female. They don't tell you that. They tell you, your interactions with other people tell you about where you stand. But it would make sense for you to be a little narcissistic about it because of the subjective values on the other side. Some people think you're an 8. Some people think you're a 6. So if you think you're an 8, then you're going to be a little tougher in negotiating and get more out of the negotiation if you're a little bit narcissistic. Okay? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yet another way that agreeable people get suckered into things.
That's exactly correct. Okay? So that's why incidentally, I don't know that anybody else has written this analysis, so I think this is going in my book, but I believe that the human being is essentially calibrated at what I call 55-45. So if we looked at the middle of the bell curve on agreeable-disagreeable, we would find that people are not 50-50 traders. Okay, people are actually, on average, the smack middle of the bell curve is 55-45, which means it's actually 10% slanted your direction. So when you get 10% more than you got coming to you, i.e. you get 55% of a transaction, it feels totally fair and even to you. That is my eyeball observation of human nature. And my eyeball observation of human nature is that when it is fair, they do not feel like it's fair. We can tell this by looking at sports fans. Sports fans routinely feel like their team gets the worst end of the refereeing, which is of course objectively impossible. Okay, so we can see that they are not so unreasonable that they cannot watch a game. In other words, if you were so incensed that the refereeing was just absolutely abhorrent, you couldn't even watch. Okay, and you'd just be murderously angry, and you'd be trashing your television set, and you'd be have referees slaughtered. Now that happens occasionally in soccer, you know, around the world. But the point is that
thinking,
in general, but in general, what you're going to see is that people are biased by a modest degree on average, and this is exactly what this person is observing. So people are essentially, and if God forbid that you are a little bit on the disagreeable side of the bell curve, so let's suppose you're a 65-35 trader, which I'm going to assume is not that uncommon. So the people that we would simply say have, quote, a strong sense of self and, quote, assertive and, quote, no, not easy to push around, we aren't saying that they're jerks or narcissistic freaks. We're just simply saying they're pretty tough and they have a sense of self. Well, that's a 65-35 trader. Okay, that's probably a standard deviation towards the disagreeable side. Not so disagreeable, not unreasonable. That's just a tough manager, good, solid attorney, you know what I mean, that doesn't give anything away, etc. Well, that person's moderately disagreeable. So that person now is very likely, part of the concept here is that they are overrating what it is that they have coming to them. Well, in order to do that, you're going to have to overrate what it is that you have to give to the coalition generally relative to other people. So now we start finding out about why the person that thinks that they should be a singer can only sing in the shower. And that's because they've got themselves overrated by a chunk. And they're built that way. Okay. So now is everybody built that way? Everybody's built that way probably a little bit. In other words, an average human. Now, some people are not. So you will find people that are inherently very agreeable that are sitting over there as 30-70 traders. And guess what? Remarkably, they never demonstrate these characteristics. So you'll never find it. Okay? In fact, if you compliment them, they'll pull their horns in and feel bashful and disagree with you. Okay? So we can watch this process, but this individual has definitely seen, as we all have, we've seen individuals that are just remarkably obtuse when it comes to understanding that they are overrating the hell out of themselves. And what they are anticipating feedback from the world is not going to happen. And so that's what you're seeing. You're essentially seeing a on average, there's a little bit of built-in narcissism into people, but it's not extreme. It's just modest, but it's in there. And it's in there, I believe, in order to make sure we take advantage of the subjective values that are sitting on the other side of the tables, because it's very possible if we're a little bit patient, we can get a substantially better deal. And so that's, I think that's in the system in order to defend against making too quick a deals. But the other side of it is it doesn't take us very long to walk our way out on the bell curve of a little bit more disagreeable, and pretty soon we're getting, you know, Sinatra in the shower, you know, and pursuing a career behind it, and essentially having to crash and burn. I know a kid right now that thinks he's going to be a rapper, and he's been at this for 6 or 7 years. And he's effectively doesn't have a hard enough work ethic to actually go get a job and learn how to do air conditioning and heating repair out here in Sacramento, which is exactly what he should be doing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But what he's doing instead is he's following his evolutionary nose to what he looks around and he looks at rappers. And what do we know about rappers, folks?
Well, they have a lot of girls around.
Yeah, well, here's another thing we know. They don't have any singing talent, okay?
Mm.
So there are people that can rap, I suppose, and they're pretty cool in how they do it. But I could rap pretty well. If you give me 47 takes on something, I could say some pretty cool stuff that could rhyme and be cute, et cetera. So in other words, it doesn't take a remarkable set of chips in order to be a rapper. If you're going to be Frank Sinatra, good luck to you, okay? And so, you know, let's hear the voice. We're going to find out if women are swooning in the aisles the first time they hear it, because that actually happened to Sinatra. But in this guy's case, nobody's swooning in the aisles. They have some shows together. I'm sure he's getting some local decent feedback occasionally from some females, but that are high. But the bottom line is that there is no way in hell this guy's going to make, you know, $38 an hour as a rapper. But he's going to do it anyway. Why? This is the chip, okay? So there's a narcissistic chip in there. There's just enough narcissism in there to keep pushing this thing along as he looks around at his competitors and says, well, I'm just as good as the guy on TV. And you know what? He probably is. Okay? Guy on TV got lucky as hell. So luck plays an enormous factor in something like this. Now, so this is why I think you're going to see quite a bit of surprising narcissism, maybe not some grossly disagreeable and disgusting degree, but a surprising degree. And I think you'll find it fairly often. What will happen a lot of times is that experience and repeated failure will shake some of it out. And if it doesn't, God help you, you're just a disagreeable narcissist. Destined to be bitter about how it is that you didn't rule the world. Yeah.
You just gave me an idea. Maybe in one of the future shows, I can mix some music and you and I can try our hand at freestyle rap, you know?
Oh boy. Yeah. I don't know. Oh, we'll talk about it. All right.
Yeah.
Let's move
All
on.
Right. All right. Next question. Dear Dr. Lyle, why do friend groups consist of people with the same or very similar attractiveness levels? Heterosexual women in a female friend group aren't trying to mate with each other, but are usually the same level of attractiveness. Is there an evolutionary explanation for this? And also, sometimes there's one person in the friend group who's significantly less attractive than the others, and what's the reason for that?
I don't think that we can pick our way through and answer specifically any given combination that somebody sees. But what we can do is we can back the camera up and realize that all decisions are being made on cost-benefit analysis. So cost-benefit analysis is the dynamic that is driving these decisions. So let's look at whether or not, first of all, we don't know that this is true. Now, it almost certainly is true, and I believe it is. So let's start to think about why that would be true. Let's suppose that I'm a female and I'm a 7, and I have a great gal that is really fun and funny, and I like her, and she's a 9. Is this going to be a problem? Well, yes, it is going to be a problem, because if you have a mate that mate would likely obviously prefer your friend. So if the two, if you're trying to hang out around your mate with your friend, you've got a problem. Okay, so this is a, so it's going to make sense for people to be relatively careful about this and to not be trying to have their mates hanging around friends of theirs who are objectively superior to them. So this makes perfect sense that the game theory would tell us that probably the best move is to make sure that your friends are not too different than you. Now, let's suppose that you have somebody that's quite a bit less attractive. Let's say a five with a pack of nines. Well, now the five is not, her mate is not really a threat. You know, her friends are not a threat to her pair bond because her guy is a five, and there's no possible way that, unless he's got too much of the narcissistic chip we just talked about, to think that he's going to get anywhere with these nines. So that's a little bit of a safer situation, but it's also a tough situation. And so it's probably not a situation that would happen that often. So probably because there's significant costs going to be associated with having a contrast effect between three good-looking girls and then one that's not very good-looking. That's going to be hard on the not very good-looking one. She's going to look probably even comparatively worse than she really is. What we're really talking about is a deep principle in perception that's called, I forget what it's called. It's called accommodation and, I can't remember what it is. In other words, if there's a, in perception and cognitive psychology, they've shown that if you have, let's suppose you have five girls who are eights and there's a girl who's a seven. Well, it's going to turn out that people will sort of rate the seven as closer to the eights because essentially she gets pulled into that mean. Whereas if it turns out that there's four eights and then there's a five, then there's a contrast effect. Okay, so as a result, now the five actually looks like she may be more than 3 points away from the mean of the eights. So this principle of essentially contrast versus accommodation, I forget what it's called. I think they both start with A. These are principles in cognitive psychology. That this is how this would work. It's essentially a contrast effect threat. So people are going to be probably aware of this
the
fairly
cheerleader
consciously.
Effect?
Yeah. Tell me what that means. What do you say?
I was just searching as you were saying. It's basically like when you see faces in groups, it makes them appear kind of like an average of all the faces together.
Oh yeah, I think that's. I think there's probably very very much something to that. And that's very good. And it's also, you can see that there would be attraction to trying to be with a group that might be a little more attractive than you, maybe to try to essentially have you, in some sense, you could be advertising that these are relatives of yours because it's very likely that they would have been in the Stone Age. And so as a result, it could essentially sort of pull up the indication of your gene quality. So I think there's a lot of probably little circuits in here and a lot of little gamesmanship that is being played. And but I think the basic issues are, number one, these decisions are made by cost benefit dynamics, that friends impose costs on you and they also confer benefits. And so as a result, you are analyzing what is the cost benefit dynamic. You could, I've had women who's were not as attractive as their attractive friends, and yet they were in extremely stable pair bonds, and their husbands were very into them, and they did not feel threatened by their more attractive friends. I have had that situation in my practice and in my career. I have also had situations more commonly where a friendship between, for example, two women, one who is more attractive, one who is less attractive, literally could not survive despite their best efforts and their attempts at being mature and very reasonable people, that it really couldn't survive under the heat that was being put on the less attractive person's relationship because of the spouse's interest in the more attractive friend. So I have seen that dynamic repeatedly in my career. So there's no question people could be missing that as a threat, and that is why you're going to tend to see packs of people who are reasonably similar in their attractiveness.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I looked this up. This is called the it's an Ebbinghaus illusion. And so they kind of apply this to when that people seem more attractive in a group than they do apart. So it's kind of what you're talking about, but maybe not exactly.
Not exactly. So. It's something else. They're talking about something else there. It's very interesting.
Okay.
It's interesting that they would be more attractive in a group. It may be some kind of subconscious concept that the group has actually is signaling to third parties that are watching it. They are signaling that these people are, in fact, acceptable to each other. And so essentially...
So the unseen characteristics.
Must be acceptable or they wouldn't be in a happy little group. Okay, so in other words, how much of a psychopathic nut can that girl be if she's got three other friends with her that are laughing and having a good time?
Right.
Okay,
so you've got some personality stuff. Yeah.
Yes. And it probably finds its way into aesthetic. I have no doubt that guys in groups are probably seen as more attractive and safer than the lone wolf, and probably for the very same reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were saying that it might be likely due to the brain averaging out of unattractive idiosyncrasies when they're all together. So it's
possible.
It's,
who knows? Very interesting.
Who knows? All right, so next question. Okay.
All right.
Dear Dr. Lyle, is it possible, this one's about diet and lifestyle, looks like. Okay.
Okay.
Is it possible for a person to be mentally healthy if they don't have close family and friends, but sticks to a health-promoting diet, exercise daily, and gets enough sleep? I've observed many folks who pay the price of their health and well-being in order to have a marriage, romantic partner, kids, in essence, a village. This is the trade the trade-off that they've chosen. But for myself, I'd rather be alone and have full freedom to do what's best for my health than be with family and friends who want me to compromise my dietary views. What say you, Dr. Lyle?
Well, there's a thread of disagreeability that's coming in this question. And that's not a bad thing. It's just an interesting thing. And I've seen people that were in situations where the family, friends, et cetera, were just kind of ridiculous and militantly anti-health. And so it was a problem. And obviously underneath those problems are some esteem dynamics that may be able to be fixed and may not be able to be fixed. But once again, all relationships carry costs and benefits. And in my estimation, people close to you should not be imposing health costs on you. That makes no sense to me. In other words, they shouldn't be acting as deterrents and naysayers and objectors to you doing things that are health promoting for you physically. And if they are, they had only better be in your village if they come with very, very high benefits relative to their costs. It is not easy to live a life that is directed towards a high standard of health. You have to make different dietary choices than the average people. You're going to have to pass up smoking. You're going to have to drink moderately or not at all. You're going to essentially have to have a commitment to living in such a way repeatedly and often that where you're making good decisions, not necessarily perfect decisions, but good decisions. And if you have someone close to you that is essentially throwing dirt on that decision-making strategy and essentially disparaging you and threatening to kick you out of the village because you're not joining in a self-destructive party, then of course the right move is the answer to the question is you can be absolutely mentally healthy and not have any close friends that are going to behave that way. The good news is that there are people out in the world, there's quite a lot of them, that are very reasonable and very intelligent and reasonably open and flexible about essentially live and let live. And would even join with you to a moderate degree on whatever path it is that you're headed in terms of health behavior. That doesn't mean that they're going to agree with everything that we think, and it doesn't mean that they're going to do everything that we're going to do. And we don't need them to. What we need them to be is to be friends, to be sexy, to be fun, to be informative, to be good partners in different ways. In other words, we need them to be good people and then not to get in our way when this particular path is important to us. And so that's how I see it. And we treat people with different opinions about how important these issues are with respect, but we are not in no way do we essentially condemn ourselves to health and fitness mediocrity because other people are intimidating us with some kind of with some kind of negative feedback. Forget it.
Mm-hmm. And I always wonder too, what about the friends or family members that they're not disagreeable about it, but they tempt you. They're like, oh, here, I made this just for you, or you sure you don't want one? So they're not actively, they're maybe unintentionally sabotaging. And of course, with me, I don't sometimes have the willpower and I'm like, oh, okay. And then it becomes, well, I just got to be careful. I either got to not go to their place because I know I'm going to be tempted, I'm going to fail, or I've got to figure something else out, which is your scene strategy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's things that I talk about, and I've done a video on this called Getting Along Without Going Along that you can probably find somewhere. I'm sure you can find a version of this on the internet on John McDougall's website. But the point of the whole thing is that we don't have to be perfect, and we don't always have to hold up to social pressure of that kind. You can dabble and make little foibles, and that's fine. That's not the point. The point is anyone who is sort of systematically attacking our position and our efforts on this, that's got to go. That needs to be addressed and possibly gently and warmly and intelligently confronted. And if they can't sort of get their act together and give us space, then essentially we're going to get the disagreeable distance between us and them, and we are going to fade our participation in that relationship down to a level that is sane and reasonable and still fits into our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great. All right. We are moving right along in this is a nice little flow here. So this next question is with regards to possessive and controlling males.
Mm-hmm.
So dear Dr. Lyle, without getting too specific about my situation, I'm curious as to what causes this behavior. Is it possible that my mate has overestimated my value and sexual attractiveness in the marketplace, or have I overestimated his value? Is this a characteristic common in males who are in recovery from addiction? Are there character traits in males that typically drive this type of behavior? I've learned a lot over the past few months about addiction and have a completely new perspective on it, but I'm not really certain what my thoughts are on this.
It's very interesting. And where this can get confusing for females is that sometimes the controlling nature of a male can be a signal that the female is very valuable, and therefore it actually tells them that they're in a good spot. This is a good spot to be impregnated because this guy really cares about me, okay? So you can let's think about the opposite signal. I don't really care who you're talking to. I don't really care where you're going. I don't care who you're hanging out with. And, hey, I'll be back here at, you know, I'll be back here at 7 or 8 o'clock tonight. And, hey, well, I'll see you if I do. And if I don't, that's cool. Whoa, that's the other side of this, okay? So we can see that if the male is not signaling any kind of jealousy or controlling this at all, that the female recognizes she's in trouble and she's not very valuable. On the other hand, if he's signaling too hard, then the question is, wait a second, do I have some controlling nut on my hand who is going to be a serious problem, okay? So so what this is about is whether or not the relationship actually has a balance that works. Now, one of the interesting things about David Buss's research is he has shown that relationships that are the best, actually the most satisfying relationships, are the ones where there's some mutual jealousy that gets activated, you know, periodically. So if that doesn't happen, I'm not saying that you have a lousy relationship. I'm just saying that statistically, relationships among humans where there is periodic waves of jealous anxiety and some jealous irritation, those are the relationships that are statistically the most satisfying. That makes sense. The reason it makes sense is it's for exactly the sorts of reasons that this woman is hypothesizing, and that is the following. Is it possible that, quote, my mate has overestimated my value or her attractiveness? In other words, he is feeling threatened by competition. He's anxious about it. He feels essentially over-rewarded, and therefore he needs to protect his win. Yeah, okay. That is that's exactly what, if you're essentially a normal human, you would like to feel a bit over-rewarded. And with it comes the anxiety. And so, and on the other hand, her other concern is, wait a second, have I actually misread this guy? And maybe I really am that much better than him. And his anxiety here is completely legitimate. It's just that I've overread his value, and he's reading the situation correctly, and I'm likely to run into a competitor that outshines him, and therefore he's got to control me. So you can see the problem that if you happen to be very possessive and jealous, your mate almost by definition has to be making inferences that maybe you're not such a great deal. Okay? This is that you're too anxious to buy the guy's car, and he starts thinking, well, wait a second, maybe I'm selling it too cheap. So the question, or the way that I would answer this individual, would be really a much more right-brained sort of question and response, which is, how happy are you? How satisfying is this relationship? Is it warm and sexy and loving and interesting? Does it have excitement periodically? You know, is this a really good spot? If it comes with some jealousy and some controllingness, you may have just got yourself a somewhat disagreeable animal that thinks it's over-rewarded. And as long as it continues and it's relatively steady and not crazy, that's not necessarily a bad place as long as you happen to be happy with it. Underneath this, to the extent that it's noxious, we are looking at two possible characteristics that could be a problem in terms of the person's true mate value, which is how disagreeable are they and how emotionally unstable are they. Okay, so those two characteristics put together are potentially exciting to some extent, because they can signal to a female that you are very much wanted and you're very important. So, and no, you can't go with so and so. It's like that can almost feel like music to a female's ear, like, ooh, wow, am I important? And boy, is he all upset about the idea of losing me. You can see how, on the one hand, that can be a very exciting inference, and on the other hand, if this is actually essentially a fairly stable characteristic of this person's personality, they could be a real pain in the ass, okay? And this could get very old pretty soon, and if it is, and if you're, quote, really not that happy, and it doesn't have enough joy in it, and you're still seeing this disagreeable and instability, then that's a sign that we have that we've got a personality that is not, you know, that is going to bring substantial costs to the emotional quality of this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very good. All right. What do you think? Time for one more question?
Let's save them for next week.
Let's save them for next week. All right, we got a good list of questions for next week. So thanks everybody for listening, Dr. Lyle. Love the explanations as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.